The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Most people, many people certainly, when they see the name Linda LaPlante, think of Prime Suspect, which first aired in 1991. And of course, Linda LaPlante is the author of both the novels and, of course, the TV series. But she has now decided to write about herself. And it's a great title for someone who writes about crime. Her memoir is called Getting Away with Murder. Linda LaPlante, good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
Now, your memoir is absolutely hugely enjoyable. It's full of laughs, and your life has been a remarkable one, but you were a reluctant memoirist.
Definitely, yeah. You know, one of my favourite crime writers is Raymond Chandler, and he was always asked to do an autobiography or a biography or a memoir, and he always said, no, who wants to know if I fell off my bicycle? And yet, when he died, so many of them came out. And I was thinking, my publishers kept saying, oh, come on, do it. And I kept saying, no. And then I thought, good, I'm so old. Maybe I should do it before I drop off. And really, that's the reason I agreed to do it. No idea how long it would take, though. Oh, hard work.
Hard work. And the problem being, as you write in your preface, you didn't remember very much.
Yes, it was one of those things, you know, when they said, oh, you know, we want to hear about when you got married or, you know, when you got divorced. I have no idea of the dates. In fact, when I did write them down, I was 10 years out on each one. And so, and it was bit by bit raking up things that probably I had buried. That I found very difficult, emotionally difficult, because I really think that whenever I had been through some big emotional impact in my life and got hurt, I just buried it. So I did have quite a few tears when beginning the book, but then I rather enjoyed the laughs. There's a lot of laughs in it.
A lot of laughs. But your childhood, it seems to have been idyllic, and the freedoms that you enjoyed, which freedoms are not much enjoyed by children these days, and you even contemplate whether or not it was because your parents wanted you to develop that free-spirited attitude to life or whether they just couldn't be bothered keeping an eye on you.
No, it was, I think, my parents, which I've only also come to terms with, had a terrible loss of their first child. Her name was Dale, and she was tragically killed age 6 in the most appalling accident with a 10-ton truck where she was caught between the wheels. And my mother stayed with her for the time she remained alive, very, very wounded. And she was pregnant with me. And then, you know, something I've only just remembered, I was born with open tear ducts. I was born weeping. And that, it was never, ever forced upon us, the loss in my family. But she was always there, portraits of her, pictures of her, photographs everywhere. And as a child, I remember picking up photographs saying, is this me or is it Dale? And my mother would say, oh, that one's Dale, that's you, because they dress me like her. But whether or not that was why we were given such freedom, because they had known what it was like to lose and no restrictions at all. And because we lived by the beach in Liverpool, we were off on our bicycles, we were playing on the sands for, hour upon hour. We did have time to come home, but there was no fear, which is quite extraordinary. Nowadays, you could not allow children the freedom we had. You know, there was a place called Sniggery Wood, which was very dark and quite frightening. And I was always peddling in there. I'd come back and my mother would say, "Where have you been? Sniggery Wood."
Now, the childhood you had, it was coloured by, you know, stories that your father might tell you. But also there's an Uncle Stanley who lived some distance away and you'd pedal over to his house. And his stories had a darkness to them that perhaps influenced your own fondness for that writing later on.
Definitely. My Uncle Stanley, I first met him, I'd be about 8. And I can remember my mother going, oh no, Stanley's here, Stanley. Now, I had never seen a man with coal black oiled hair. He was very suntanned and he was wearing a white T-shirt and a navy blue striped jacket. Now, I'd never seen anybody wearing clothes like that. When he sat down and took the jacket off, he had arms full of tattoos. And he had run away to sea when he was 12 years old. His house was like a magical museum of the most wondrous things, from Buddhas to paintings, and his stories about being on the old sailing ships. And I remember him once teaching me about Japanese hirikiri, how they commit suicide. He had an actual samurai's mat, and he showed me the sword and demonstrated to me how the sword would go into the right side and cut across the stomach and up to the heart. And if the suicide was complete by getting to the heart, all their wrongdoings would be forgiven. And I used to go to this funny little school, a bit like St. Trinian's, and I can remember teachers' names. And this was Miss Cartwright. And Miss Cartwright caught me in the midst of demonstrating to the pupils around me hirikiri. And she said, "Linda, what are you doing?" And I had this little mat with a ruler. And I said, "Well, Miss Cartwright, I'm showing hirikiri." She said, "Hiri what? Kiri, what is that?" I said, "It's Japanese suicide, samurai." And she said, "Do stop doing that immediately." And that, you know, he taught me so much. His letters to me from all around the world, and when I read them now, you read them as if you're reading a young man traveling the world, and he was already 90. Extraordinary man, absolutely extraordinary.
Now, people listening to you now, as you recount the tales of Uncle Stanley, realize that you're a terrific actress, never mind a writer, for which you are latterly more famous. But in going to RADA, which you did, you've got two teachers to thank. A Miss Ash, number one, I mean, who recognised that you had dyslexia, which was only a different way of seeing the world rather than a handicap.
Absolutely. But she noticed it because I was pretending to read a book upside down. And she said, "What can't you see? Do you need glasses, Linda?" And I said, no, it's just all the words are mixed up. And she said, What do you mean? I said, "Well, I can't tell the letters which is which." And she formed an alphabet for me with, so for A, there would be an apple and an ape. So I learned A. And by her slow teaching of this phonetic alphabet, I was able to read. And then after that, obsessively so, I couldn't stop reading. But nobody in my family had any artistic bent, or I never went to the theatre. So where did that come from? Just a suggestion by a voice teacher, "You should be an actress." And, you know, I don't know whether it's the Liverpool in me, but I went, "Oh, all right, yes, okay." So she said, "There's an academy called RADA. I'm going to apply for you to do an audition there." I didn't even really know what the word audition was, never mind anything else. But I remember saying to my father, I'm going to go to RADA. I think he said, is that a pub? He had no idea what it was. The freedom I had was to allow me, age 15, dropped off at the station in Lime Street, to get to Euston Station in London by myself, a little note to go to Gower Street in a taxi and have this audition for RADA. Extraordinary.
And Miss McCormack, another teacher who prepared you for RADA, she was like a gemstone shining in silt, is exactly the way you put it. But she drilled you so that you would have a chance of passing that audition, even though you were underage for admission to RADA. And
underage. But do you know something? It was, I was so naive. Perhaps if somebody had said, there are only 4 to 50, 60 places available at the Royal Academy and maybe 5,000 people auditioning and applying, I might have had a bit of nerve. But because I had no notion of what the Royal Academy was, and when I went on stage, I said, I'm doing St. Joan. And this rather plummy voice said, yes. I said, well, she was a French girl who was burnt at the stake. We are aware of who Joan of Arc was. Just get on and do it. And then I realized I was in white high-heel shoes. So I said, could I take my shoes off? Yes, of course. Then I thought, you know, I've got a frilly underskirt. So I then said, do you mind if I also take my underskirt off? They said, yes, as long as you're not taking anything else off, please audition. And, you know, by the luck of the gods, I was in. I got a scholarship.
Now, what a life you had as an actress. First of all, your landlady, and we could have a huge conversation about this landlady who had pursued a career riding horses through flaming hoops and who was acquainted with Laurence Olivier, which acquaintance ended up in tatters. But that's maybe time for another conversation. But you're, in the course of your career, you're surrounded by people that we now know as household names, like John Hurt, Ian McShane, he of Lovejoy, Tony or Anthony Hopkins. And this was after you'd already trod the boards and developed quite a skill in comic timing.
Yeah. You see, I the only TV programmes I remember and recall watching as a child with my family were the Brian Ricks Whitehall farces. To them, that was the pinnacle of art and theatre. And I worked, my very first job out of the Royal Academy was auditioning for Brian Ricks. And I was so fascinated by the old farceurs, the way they could do double, treble trips. They taught me timing. They taught me so much. They were all absolutely incredible. They'd all been on, you know, various summer shows. They'd traveled. They'd all been on tours. And they taught me how comedy. And later on, when I was at the Playhouse Theatre in Liverpool, Anthony Hopkins was absolutely furious with me. He said, how come every time you walk off the stage, you get a round? I'm off the stage and I walk off and I get nothing. I said, well, you have to give an indication that they can applaud. He said, what do you mean? So I said, you don't have to actually do a funny trip. What you have to do is give the audience a sign they can laugh. And he said, show me what you're doing. And I showed him. And the next performance, he got around and he was jumping up with joy. He said, I did it. It was so simple. I just raised my eyebrow. And tiny little notes I'd learnt from the farce masters. They were masters. Put me in very good stead for the rest of my career, really.
Now, your career, I suppose we could divide it into two parts, your acting career, and there are all sorts of accounts of getting your big break in Calamity Jane and how you developed the part. Was that in Liverpool? I think it was. And it never did transfer to the West End because of a row over who might or should be headlining in the West End rather than someone from the provinces. But the second part of your career is all about your writing and the production of television shows, the development of Jane Tennyson, meeting the mafia in order to understand their thinking. I mean, yes. What an extraordinary life you've had.
I think because the mafia came into it, because after Widows, they were very interested in America, of making an American series of it. And I was trying to think what location would be good for an American version. And I chose to begin research in Atlantic City. But I was failing badly. They have all these film kind of contacts that you can contact, and they can introduce you to the police. They can introduce you to locations for filming. But I was getting nowhere. And I happened to be watching Linda Ronstadt on stage. And because I was staying at Sands Casino in Atlantic City. And she came on stage at one point and she said, I'm going to sing a song. I'm going to use a prop. I'm very worried about it because it's rather dangerous, but the management want it. And I'm going to be singing Falling in Love Again. And down came this swinging moon. And she sat on a little seat in the moon and sang Falling in Love Again, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And I noticed two men sitting in a few rows down filming. And I just happened to notice them. But I also noticed that when she stopped the song, they got up and left. And the manager of the casino, who had been very, very helpful to me up to then, he came up and he said, is everything all right? And I said, yes. I said, you see those two men going out of the door? They've just filmed Linda Ronstadt saying she was very concerned about the stunt. And I don't know, they filmed it. So she may be having trouble with her contract. I just threw that in. And he walked off. Later, he came up to me and he said, gracias. Now, I had no idea he was Italian. He was very Harvard educated. And later that night, he came and he said, what exactly are you here for? And I told him about trying to find a plot for an American version of a show I'd done in London. And he said, you need to go to Palermo. I said, why? He said, well, you will find a lot there, very big interest in crime. He said, I'm going to introduce you to my uncle. And this uncle in Atlantic City just said, you should go to Palermo. I can arrange for you to meet people there. Now, maybe some people will go, I wasn't going to set it in Palermo. I don't know about this. But off I went, and they were mafioso. I stayed in a villa that was very closely monitored, armed guards patrolling up and down. And you see, I had nobody organizing this. This was done by me on the phone, thanking people effusively, and I got access to the biggest mafia trial in history. 350 mafiosos on trial in court in Palermo. One of them began to talk to me and he said, I can guide you. I'll do his voice. You know, he says, I can guide you. I can help you a lot. I can give you to women. I can give you to men. I can give you everything you want for a crime. So he did. He gave me extraordinary development and you know, I wasn't then writing Bella Mafia. Suddenly I was. And he, at the end of this time, he said, you have to be very careful for me because I'm giving you information. And if it gets out, you know, I could be in trouble. You understand me, Linda? Be very careful what I tell you. So I said, I'm going to be so careful. I really will. I'll give you the manuscript. So many months later, I gave him the manuscript. And he went away with it and he came back. And this was in Los Angeles, by the way, he'd come there. And he sat down and he said, it's very good, very good. But I have one problem. Nobody is going to know that it is me. So I said, well, that was the point. He said, no, no, a little bit, just a little bit, please. So that was Paul Carolla in Bella Mafia.
Now, Linda, I'm afraid we have to leave it there. I think people have got a flavour of how much is in your memoir. It's really terrific. It's very entertaining, full of stories, both short and tall. It's called Getting Away with Murder. It's a memoir from Linda LaPlante. And Linda, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Pat. Thank you.
Now,
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.